From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Marvel Studios saves the day for movie fans at Comic-Con. Then, in the documentary The Great Hack, filmmakers examine the Facebook data breach and show us how exposed we all are.
This is an invisible world, and we wanted it to become visible so that when people thought about it, they had this image of how we are continually leaking data with all of the little things that we're doing, whether it's buying a coffee or whether it's getting a Metro card.
We hang out with guitarist Rodrigo E. Gabriela, and we say goodbye to New Orleans legend Art Neville. All that coming up on The Frame.
This is Larry Mantle. Join me for our next Film Week screening, Boogie Nights, 1970s LA's porn industry in transition. Saturday night, July 27th at the Theater at Ace Hotel. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person.
The past 4 days were the Super Bowl for pop culture fans as Comic-Con International in San Diego welcomed new trailers, pilots, and project announcements. A lot of the big movie studios took the year off, but Disney and Marvel were back with some big announcements, like this one from Taika Waititi, the director of Thor.
For those of you who know that storyline, it's incredible. It's full of emotion and love and thunder. And it introduces, for the first time, female Thor. So, for us, there's only one person who could play that role. Only one. And she's here. I'm going to introduce her to you now. Please, welcome to the stage, Natalie Portman.
Natalie Portman couldn't make it to KPCC today, but Mike Rowe could. That's because he's the arts and entertainment editor for our website, LAist, and he has been to his fair share of Comic-Cons. Mike had enough energy left to make his way downstairs to our studio to talk about how this year's event stacked up against past iterations.
I think it depends what you're into. You know, if you're there for the movies, a lot of the movie studios sort of pulled back a little bit this year. While if you're a big TV fan, I think it's better than ever because there was more attention on television. There were some great shows that sort of premiered and debuted their shows there. So that was great.
So let's talk more about television, because I think maybe 5 years ago, television was just kind of getting a serious toehold at Comic-Con, and now I think there's no dispute. There's a lot better stuff on TV and streaming sites than there is in movie theaters. So what were the shows that stood out and what were you really excited about?
I think that HBO made a really big move this year in premiering a lot of stuff there. They had big panels for His Dark Materials, the new show with James McAvoy and Lin-Manuel Miranda. They did a lot of promotion for Watchmen around the Comic-Con. You know, that's one thing that's happened a lot is shows taking advantage of Comic-Con, but not even holding a panel for it. But they had like some off-sites off the main location of Comic-Con, and they dropped the trailer on social media, even though they didn't officially have everyone from the cast there to promote it.
Those of us who weren't in San Diego, who haven't been to Comic-Con, why is it such a big deal? Why do you go back every year? And why is it important, not just for fans, but for the industry?
You know, I think that it's an amazing place for creative people to come together. You can sort of see what's coming next in pop culture. You can celebrate what's been before. And, you know, you're around hundreds of thousands of other fans there. So it's a really exciting time.
And it is named Comic-Con. When I go, and I haven't been in a year, there's some great comics to browse through. Does anybody look through old comics anymore?
You know, I think the floor of Comic-Con was more packed than I've seen it in years. You know, I think that there are fans coming back to comics, and you can sort of see how comics are influencing the movies, too. I think it's getting a little bit more attention now.
So Comic-Con has always been a very important place to launch new shows and new movies. Were there some launches that were really important, especially for streaming services like maybe Hulu or Netflix? I know there's a new Star Trek series on CBS All Access. What kind of popped in terms of the new TV shows that were launched at Comic-Con?
I think that Star Trek Picard got a lot of attention after it dropped its trailer. People didn't really know what to expect, and they showed that they are bringing back some of the old cast members from the Next Generation show and going in some sort of bold new directions that I think that have fans very excited. I think there was sort of a mixed response to Netflix's big show, The Witcher, that promoted with Henry Cavill starring. You know, Netflix, though, is having a bigger presence. Hulu's having a bigger presence. They did a big announcement with Veronica Mars. They showed the pilot of it and then announced that all the episodes of the show were dropping on social media where no one at Comic-Con could watch them because they were at Comic-Con.
Oh, my goodness. We're talking with Mike Rowe, the arts and entertainment editor at LAist, about Comic-Con. So Game of Thrones is off the air, and yet they still did a Comic-Con panel, and it sounds like it was almost as problematic as the entire last season of Game of Thrones. What happened?
You know, they actually had a Game of Thrones panel this year, but at the last second, I believe a day before, the showrunners announced they weren't going to show up. Several of the cast members pulled out. So they held a panel, and it was a little contentious. They even went out ahead of the panel to tell everybody to be polite about things because of the fan reception.
And you showed up? Did you go to this?
I was
or did
in the room
you boycott
for it
as well?
I have some friends who are in the room for it, and there was actually some booing at portions of the panel because of the cast very much defending the final season of the show. But, you know, they're out there. They have to do their jobs and promote it. So,
final question is Marvel and Disney. Now, obviously, that is the category killer at Comic-Con. And Marvel, I think, laid out their movies through the next millennium. What were the highlights in terms of headlines? What was the big news? Because I think I saw Natalie Portman is going to play Thor, which sounds super cool.
Yeah, you know, you can definitely see where they're pulling from in the comics. They did a long-running female Thor storyline in the comics. You know, you can sort of see how now that's playing into the movies. It's a very, very diverse lineup. They announced the first Asian-led movie for Marvel with a very largely almost all-Asian cast, including Awkwafina, you know, Simu Liu playing the lead. It was really fascinating to see, although I don't think this is the full Phase 4 announcement. They have the Disney D23 announcements next month. They announced about 5 movies this time around, but at the very end of the panel, they said, oh, we didn't even have time to talk about Black Panther 2, Captain Marvel 2, Fantastic Four. So I think we're going to hear more about those next month.
People who haven't been to Comic-Con know that cosplay is a huge part of the convention. I suspect you went again as Ant-Man. Correct me if I'm mistaken. But what were the great costumes on the floor of Comic-Con that really jumped out that you were blown away by?
You know, I enjoyed seeing from the most recent Avengers Endgame, there was a lot of fat Thors around playing the Big Lebowski version from that film. Also, my favorite surprising cosplay was I saw multiple Midsommar cosplayers out there. So it was pretty fun.
Meaning they're all dressed in white and they had very unusual baked goods with them?
Exactly.
Mike Rowe is the arts and entertainment editor for our website, LAist.com. That's LAIST.com. Mike, thanks for coming downstairs.
Thank you, John.
Coming up on The Frame, the documentary The Great Hack will make you think twice about the personal information that you share online. There's no question that personal data has been exploited by companies like Facebook. But what happens when that information doesn't just create ads that creepily target you, but also is used to undermine democracy? That's the argument at the center of the new documentary, The Great Hack, which investigates the controversial firm Cambridge Analytica. Co-founded by Donald Trump's former advisor Steve Bannon, Cambridge harvested private information from tens of millions of Facebook users without their permission and used that data for campaigns including Brexit and Trump's presidential race. Kareem Amer and Jahan Nujame are the co-directors of The Great Hack, and their film follows Brittany Kaiser, a former Cambridge Analytica employee turned whistleblower. She was subpoenaed by Robert Mueller, and David Carroll, a media professor in New York.
You are looking for characters that are going to take you into rooms that you'd never otherwise get to see, adventures through this world, and to take you deep inside the belly of the beast. So first of all, we found David, and we understood that David was about to go on a journey. And with these kinds of films, you want to be jumping off a cliff with somebody.
In order to send people personalized messages, you need people's data. And Cambridge Analytica claim to have 5,000 data points on every American voter.
Hopefully they'll allow you into their lives to go along on the ride.
But it was invisible. And so the question is, how do you make the invisible visible?
Where is my data and what has been done with it? And then he was ready to get a UK solicitor, a UK lawyer, to sue Cambridge Analytica for getting his data back and understanding that very basic question.
And the hypothesis was that US voter data
was processed by Cambridge Analytica's parent company, in Great Britain.
And so by following him on this journey and asking this very simple question, we could really understand what happens to all of our data. So for us, he represented the everyman, all of us. For Brittany, she was coming out of the belly of the beast, or trying to. And when we heard about her, we just could not believe the different worlds that she had been in.
I was part of the team running Obama's Facebook. We invented the way social media is used to communicate with voters.
She started to take on different projects, and at a certain point, your boss looks at you and says, well, aren't you a professional? You're here to do a job. And she got to the point where she said, it's like a lawyer. You know, you take jobs from all different kinds of clients. So she's pitched the Trump campaign, wrote their first contract, was investigated by Mueller. She's had ties to Julian Assange. So our jaws kept dropping as she revealed another one of her connections and another piece of her life.
We're talking with Jahan Nujain and Karim Amer about their film, The Great Hack. I want to play a clip from the film. This is Brittany Kaiser breaking down how Cambridge Analytica used Facebook user data to tailor political ads.
Remember those Facebook quizzes that we used to form personality models for all voters in the US? The bulk of our resources went into targeting those whose minds we thought we could change. Our creative team designed personalized content to trigger those individuals until they saw the world the way we wanted them to.
And it's used not just in Brexit and in the election of Donald Trump, but in places like Trinidad and Tobago. So I assume, outside of what you show in Mark Zuckerberg's testimony, Facebook had no interest in going on camera with you guys?
We tried. We reached out, but they did not have any interest in going on camera.
Whatsoever.
I want to ask you about another central character in this film. It's Alexander Nix. He's the CEO of Cambridge Analytica. And there's a moment in the film where he kind of portrays himself as the victim in all of this. And I'm wondering, did you feel that were it not him, it would have been somebody else? Was he just filling a vacuum that he was going to come along in some iteration or another? It just happened to be him at the right time. He was just taking advantage of stuff that was out there.
Julian Wheatland has a great quote in the film, which I love. He's the COO of Cambridge Analytica, and he says, you know, this technology is being used not only by us, but many other companies, and it's just going to be increasingly used.
This technology is going on unabated and will continue to go on. That because of the way that this technology is moving so fast and people don't really understand it, and because there's a lot of concerns about it, there was always going to be a Cambridge Analytica.
This is just a microcosm of the bigger story, but it's a pretty perfect microcosm because it really brings up all of the questions. And I think before beginning this film, it was hard to know even what kinds of questions we should be asking.
The reality is that, you know, Cambridge Analytica is not the reason why what happened happened, right? Cambridge Analytica did not create the multi-billion-dollar business of the American election cycle that attracts now, you know, different election contractors to come work here and explore. Cambridge Analytica is not the reason why there's no legislation that protects American voter data. Cambridge Analytica is not the reason why we have kind of been continuing to operate in this barter system whereby we give all of our data for free as our admission fee into the connected world, and in return have no privacy. So I think it was the perfect storm. That's not to say that what they did do, which is actively engage in voter suppression tactics, which should not be part of what we stand for. I think what he's saying is, you know, don't blame me that your democracy is for sale.
We're talking with Jahan Nujain and Karim Amer about their film, The Great Hack. I want to play something from your film from a whistleblower named Christopher Wiley.
It's incorrect to call Cambridge Analytica a purely sort of data science company or an algorithm, you know, company. You know, it is a full-service propaganda machine.
And kind of like people who speak out about the Church of Scientology, they're labeled apostates and they're discredited. And it feels like outside of what happens inside Cambridge Analytica, there's also circles outside of Cambridge Analytica that try to discredit its critics. And I'm wondering, because you include some people who think that some of these whistleblowers have ulterior motives, how do you figure out if the whistleblowers have different motivations than shining a light on something that needs to be examined.
You know, whistleblowers, we may have an overly romantic view of who they are and where they come from. I mean, oftentimes to blow the whistle, you need to be engaged in an endeavor that's sometimes questionable in itself, right? So, you know, whistleblowers are complicated people and they play an important role in society, but their complexity is important to be noted and their interests are important to be noted. And I think that when we look at kind of, you know, there's been a lot of debate about what makes a whistleblower and what doesn't make a whistleblower in the context of this story.
Is it important, do you think, that one of the people who launched Cambridge Analytica, Steve Bannon, who worked with Donald Trump and worked at Breitbart News, who has really tried to make money off of the idea of fear and otherness and nationalism, that's not, to me, totally random that he ended up working with Cambridge Analytica and they took advantage of people who are afraid of others?
I don't think it's random that Steve Bannon was involved. And I don't think it's random that the Mercer family was involved.
The Mercer family, we should add, is the backer of Breitbart News.
Yeah, and of Cambridge Analytica. I think it's very strange when you start to see that these same funding networks are happening across the world. And that's to credit Carol Cadwalladr, the investigative journalist who we feature in the film and who brought the world attention to the story in many ways. Her initial articles were key for us because what Carol was able to do, she was able to show the interconnected nature of the story from a transatlantic lens.
This is not a partisan issue. I cannot say that more strongly. This is about the integrity of our democracy. It's about our national sovereignty.
Meaning that in order to understand the phenomena of Donald Trump's ascent to power using Facebook, you also had to understand Brexit. And in order to understand Brexit, you had to understand Trump. And when you compared the two together, you got a more holistic perspective of what had actually happened. What's most worrisome, perhaps, is that we do have people like Steve Bannon who understand that this is a battle of mythology and that if you can use the data that companies like Facebook and Google gladly hand out without any kind of regulation whatsoever, you can create customized fear loops for people that are so effective and that are happening in darkness without people even being aware of it.
I wonder about how you hope people look at data and propaganda and elections maybe in a more informed way after looking at this film.
This is an invisible world, and we wanted it to become visible so that when people thought about it, they had this image in their minds of how we are continually leaking data with all of the little things that we're doing, whether it's buying a coffee or whether it's getting a Metro card.
Data is recordable human behavior. Think of it as there is a voodoo doll of you out there to create an emotional pulse of who you are, where you are, and what's the best time, place, and message to speak to you. And that is part of the platform system that Google and Facebook operate on.
Kareem and Jahan, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kareem Ammer and Jahan Nujain are the co-directors of the documentary The Great Hack. It's on Netflix and in select theaters on July 24th. Coming up on The Frame, two guitarists share their love of their favorite instrument in a guitar shop. The guitar duo Rodrigo y Gabriela released a new album earlier this year called Metavolution. It's another example of the amazing sound they create with just two instruments. The Mexico City-born musicians came through Los Angeles recently, and The Frame contributor Beto Arcos found the perfect setting to talk with them about, what else, guitars.
The old-style guitar shop is located in a residential area of Silver Lake, two blocks north of the 101 freeway. There are two rooms filled with all kinds of acoustic and electric guitars and other string instruments. That's where I suggested an interview with guitarists Rodrigo Sanchez and Gabriela Quintero, better known as Rodrigo y Gabriela. When they arrived and began looking around, the owner told them they could try anything they liked. I asked Gabriela about the instruments they play.
We play Yamaha custom-made guitars, and they have a special a kind of little piezo so they can absorb all the acoustic sounds and the percussion on the acoustics, but then without the feedback. So then we'll be able to play it in a big PA, almost like a rock ambiance. And so it will sound big as a rock band, but without the feedback.
Rodrigo y Gabriela's sound is a combination of different elements. They were previously in a metal rock group. The sound of a full band was already part of their DNA. Rodrigo plays most of the melodies, while Gabriela builds the rhythms and the bass lines, both powered by loud amplifiers. Rodrigo y Gabriela are constantly on tour. When they're on the road, they each take about 5 guitars. Gabriela says, unlike some of their rock friends who may take a Gibson and a Fender, their situation is different.
And we have that's like a clone guitars, just in case one of them breaks. Because they're still, even though they're very good guitars, they're still weak. Every day we kind of evolve in our sounds and in the way we play and all of that. And sometimes the things breaks, and sometimes things are not captivating the new way, the new riff or the new whatever. So we need to be safe on the end of having all of those guitars.
I asked Rodrigo and Gabriela if they play or practice when they're not touring. At first, they hesitated how to respond.
We I mean, when we are not on the road, we have a studio. And it's sort of at least my favorite place. I mean, I do other stuff. I play soccer and all that. But we have like an office job, even though we're not on tour. But we always have something to do. I mean, we have a next tour coming in a month. So we want to work on something. Or we want to just write new music. And so we spend like every morning in the studio, like from 11 to 3 to 4. That's our office job. Yeah.
As we were talking in the guitar shop, someone was playing an electric guitar in the background. It got me thinking again about the sound Rodrigo y Gabriela create with their 2 acoustic guitars. Gabriela says it was their precarious financial condition that helped them create a rock band sound.
It needed to be done because it was survival. It was a way we were surviving. We wanted to travel and play without knowing anybody, without any security as such. So,
in the late 1990s, Rodrigo y Gabriela split from the metal band, left Mexico, and moved to Dublin. Their only goal was to make a living from playing music. They couldn't find a gig at a restaurant or pub, so they became buskers on Dublin's famous Grafton Street. Their music took off and they started to build a career playing in pubs. In 2002, they started touring all over Ireland, then the rest of Europe.
We didn't want to become like a guitar hero, like the fastest or the fastest scales or the fastest rhythm or something like that. And it just came out naturally. We wanted to find a sound that emerged, you know, and it was mostly subconscious. It wasn't like intentional.
Yeah, no, I agree. You said it all. Yeah.
He's going, what's this? They're supposed to be selling 10,000 people. They turn up with a van.
That's Carlo Poli. He's been Rodrigo y Gabriela's road manager from the beginning. Over the past 15 years, Poli has seen them play everywhere, from the smallest comedy club in Cardiff with 50 people to 10,000 at Red Rocks Amphitheater in Colorado. He says he never gets tired of seeing the crew reaction.
We get like 4 trucks full of gear turning up, and it's nowhere near as close to what you've just done with regards to the performance.
Rodrigo says much has changed in the music industry since their early days as buskers more than 15 years ago. But he says one thing remains clear to both.
But if you want to create your own sound, you really need to know how to play. That's real. Because otherwise, I mean, everyone can make music with the computer and all that. But to transcend, you need to really practice. And that's something that we did and we still do.
For The Frame, I'm Beto Arcos.
Rodrigo y Gabriela will perform at the Greek Theater on July 23rd. And we close today with this. Art Neville, the oldest of the famed Neville brothers, died today. He had a solo career before starting the group with his three brothers, and then he formed the quintessential New Orleans funk band, The Meters. Art Neville's death comes not long after New Orleans lost two other music greats, Dr. John and Dave Bartholomew. One of Art's brothers, Charles, died last year. The Neville brothers' final concert was in 2012 at the Hollywood Bowl. Art Neville was 81 years old. And that's our show for today. I'm John Horn in the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC. We're back here tomorrow.